Well, hi, everybody. And we are resuming now with the very beginning of externalization of the hierarchy, which I skipped over when I began the analysis. I worked from page 61 to 701, and now we're just taking from page 0 to page 61, and here we are at page 15, and we're working regarding the esoteric schools and disciplines. We've just now completed this section on the training of psychics. Interesting that it should be one of the first to be dealt with. The article was written in the 1930s, around 1934. And maybe, as I said, there was no certainty that there would be the continuation on the physical plane of the Great War, the so-called war to end all wars, but it was not. It just went underground, you know. So now this second factor to be considered is esoteric schools and disciplines. And we have another question. The second question relates to the work of the esoteric schools. Now he is dealing with esoteric matters when he's talking about the training of psychics, and also speaking of the kinds of processes the esoteric schools are going through now. Okay. So our second question relates to the work of the esoteric schools or disciplines, as they are sometimes called, and the training and safeguarding of aspirants found working in them. It's a thorny path and a dangerous path, and the dangers are not those of which the incoming student is really aware. Not at first, and obscure dangers and attacks can be part of the expected situation, plus the general problem of glamour. Okay, I would first of all like to make one point clear. The great hindrance to the work of the majority of the esoteric schools at this time is their sense of separateness and their intolerance of other schools and methods. Their leaders, the leaders of these schools, need to absorb the following fact. All schools which recognize the influence of the Trans-Himalayan Lodge and whose workers are linked consciously or unconsciously with such masters of the wisdom as Master Moria or Master K.H. Kutumi, form one school and are part of one discipline. All right, so the avoidance of the great heresy of separateness is really important. And there are so many. Well, this was 80-something years ago, but it's still possible to have this kind of separatism when one school considers another, and even when Master Moria and Master K.H. and D.K. are respected and people are studying under the outflow that came from them. Still, separativeness is frequently found. But DK tells us there is no essential conflict of interests. And on the inner side, if they are in any way functioning effectively, the various schools and presentations are regarded as a unity. There is no basic difference in the teaching, even if the terminology used may vary. And the technique of work is fundamentally identical. If the work of the great ones is to go forward, and as desired, in these days of stress and world need, it is imperative that these various groups should begin to recognize their real unity in goal, guidance from particular masters and their initiates, and technique, and that their leaders should realize that it is fear of other leaders and the desire that their group should be numerically the most important, which prompts the frequent use of the words, well, this is a different discipline, or their work is not the same as ours. That is problematic. Okay. Now, this is a long paragraph. It is this attitude which is hindering the growth of spiritual life and understanding among the many students gathered into the many outer organizations. Is it still going on? I guess, speaking as one who is fairly experienced in the interplay between the various groups, I would say yes, it is still going on. At this time, the great heresy of separateness taints them. The leaders and members talk in terms of our and your, of this discipline and that, and of this method being right, usually their own, and the other methods which may be right, but it is probably doubtful, if not positively wrong. Each regards their own group as specifically pledged to them and to their mode of instruction. Very Bucyrian, isn't it? You know, as we find in the Gemini labors of Hercules. So each of these leaders, they regard their own group as specifically pledged to them and to their mode of instruction, and threaten their members with dire results if they cooperate with the membership of other groups. Not very encouraging. And, you know, unfortunately, not realized. And with little attempt to correct this kind of separative attitude. There is this feeling of distrust of the methods used by the others. And as DK says, yes, fear. Fear that in some way the other group, be it small or large, may outpace one's own group and become more popular and more numerically attended. All of these very egoistic and personality motives enter. But instead, something else. Instead, they should recognize that all students in analogous schools and working under the same spiritual impulses are members of the one school and are linked together in a basic subject of unity. All of this is the outpouring of the one fundamental school of occultism in Shambhala and of its four main divisions, the Trans-Himalayan, the Southern Indian, the school for the fourth root race, and the coming Occidental school, which will be more the product of the sixth root race and includes Master Hilarion and Master R. So the time must come when these various and at present separative esoteric bodies will have to proclaim their identity. When the leaders and workers and secretaries, there's a term for mentor, and that is the term used in the arcane school. When the leaders and workers and secretaries will meet with each other and learn to know and understand each other. Someday, this recognition and understanding will bring them to the point where they will endeavor to supplement each other's efforts, exchange ideas with each other, and so in truth and indeed constitute one great college of esotericism in the world, with varying classes and grades, but all occupied with the work of training aspirants and preparing them for discipleship, or superintending the work of disciples as they prepare themselves to take initiation and notice the idea of self-preparation involved there. It's not that someone else prepares us for initiation. There may be hints, there may be guidance, there may be instruction, but we are the ones who process the necessary eliminations, the necessary purifications, the necessary acquisition of knowledge, the necessary sustainment of a certain point of tension. As the Buddha said in his last sermon, rely upon yourselves. So, supplementation can occur, mutual assistance, and in some cases it does occur. But the personal prejudices of the leaders and those most in a directorial capacity seems to color the groups and cause a kind of rebuff between a particular group and another, which is colored by the personal preferences of their leaders and those in the most responsible positions. Now, all this has to be seen and surmounted, wouldn't you say? This is about 85 years ago, we're talking, that this is being written. Well, basically, what we're trying to do is we know another series of bridging treatises is coming, because the Tibetan has not completed the three. He's completed two of them, at least to the extent that he deemed wise. When we talk about completion, well, you know, we can only absorb a very little bit. But a third is coming. And the best way to prepare for that third outflowing of knowledge and guidance from an expert teacher is to assimilate what is possible from the two outpourings that he has already offered through two people who served as an amanuensis, Madame Blavatsky and Alice Bailey. Okay. All of these schools are occupied with the work of training aspirants and preparing them for discipleship, or further along, superintending the work of disciples as they prepare themselves to take initiation. So it's the constitution of one great college of esotericism in the world with varying classes and grades, if we could only see it that way. But then, of course, the danger is, you know, that our group is higher on the ladder of attainment than your group and so forth. You teach a lower type of class, we teach a higher type of class. So really, the heart has to be open to recognize the unity of the effort. Then we'll cease the present attempt to hinder each other's work by comparison of methods and of techniques, by criticism and defamation, by warning and the cult of fear. I warn you against becoming involved with that group, you know. It is deficient in the following ways compared to our group, you know. You know the story. By warning and the cult of fear, and by or the insistence on exclusiveness. If you study with us, you can't study with them. And you know that this has been sometimes the attitude of even the most advanced of the modern esoteric schools. It is these attitudes and methods which are at this time hindering the entrance of the pure light of truth. Well, fairly obvious, isn't it? When we're involved in this field, we're going to come in contact with others who are similarly involved through other groups, and we have the choice of whether we will work cooperatively or whether we somehow develop a superiority complex and recommend against the work of the other groups. Aspirants in these schools present a different problem from that of ordinary psychism and mediumship, which, you know, which we've been dealing with just in the previous essay, The Training of Psychics. So these men and women have offered themselves for intellectual training and have subjected themselves to a forcing process which is intended to bring the full flower of the soul into premature blossoming, well, at least ahead of the normal blossoming, you know, so that people can be available or helpful service sooner rather than later. And this in order to more rapidly and effectively serve the race and to cooperate with the plan of hierarchy. That is, of course, the goal. So a different problem is involved here. And with it, you know, we should be somewhat familiar and be able not to fall into that particular obstruction. Such students thereby lay themselves open to the dangers and difficulties which would have been avoided had they chosen to go the slower and equally sure way. So there are risks, yes, risks on the path of occultism due to the forcing process, the motive of which should be availability for service sooner rather than later. So we have to take into consideration when we're involved in this forcing process that the slower way is equally sure, and that everybody who adheres to it rather than choosing the forced and forcing way will indeed get there. This fact should be realized by all workers in such schools, and the problem carefully explained to the entering aspirant so that he may be on his guard and adhere with care to the rules and instructions. He should not be permitted to be afraid or to refuse to subject himself to this forcing process, but he should enter upon it with his eyes wide open. Now, this is about counting the cost, and should be taught to avail himself of the safeguards offered and the experience of the older students, which can be imparted by, you know, the mentors and secretaries who have a better idea of what may be confronted and when it is confronted, that it is confronted. In other words, they know what is happening, because most probably they have been there. And they know there is no sense of rush or hurry, even in this forcing process, and yet there is no time to lose. No, these are from the rules of the road, which should be under our belt as we undertake our studies and meditative work. Those who think they are beyond the need to study the rules of the road and assimilate them often break those rules to the detriment of their progress. So let's keep that in mind. In Discipleship 1, you'll find the rules of the road, and they are so sound, you know. It may take a little humility, as DK might say, for the learned aspirant to subject himself to those rules, but it is necessary. Master, the word learned is interesting because it involves the accumulation and assimilation of knowledge, and Master DK is said to be the most learned of the masters, especially in the areas of rheology, esoteric astrology, and the study of the creative hierarchies. Now, obviously, that only goes so far because the masters are of the fifth degree, and there are those of the sixth and seventh and eighth and ninth and so forth with maybe, I think, much more experience than the master of the fifth degree. But those things are so far ahead of us that while we can speculate, we cannot know anything for certain. Regarding speculation, you know, may it be intelligent, may it be reasonable. it is inevitable, I think. The emphasis in all esoteric schools is necessarily and rightly laid upon meditation. Now, the new and forthcoming schools are called the schools of meditation. They are the esoteric schools of meditation. And meditation, representing the first ray aspect, comes first. Study, the second ray aspect, and service, the third ray aspect, the activity aspect. Technically speaking, meditation is the process whereby the head center is awakened, brought under control, and used. And that's going to bring us into the state of identification or high contemplation or samadhi in its various categories. So technically speaking, meditation is the process whereby the head center, the master center, is awakened, brought under control, and used. It's almost as if we can't really meditate until this head center and within it the 12-petaled lotus above the head has been activated. When this is the case, this awakening, control, and use, the soul and the personality are coordinated and fused, and at-one-ment takes place, producing in the aspirant a tremendous inflow of spiritual energy, galvanizing his whole being into activity, and bringing to the surface the latent good and also evil. Probably many of us have experienced this, that the closer the light, the greater the ability to, or necessity to encounter the dark. And that has to be lived through, dismissed and lived through, understood, of course, dismissed and lived through. So, you know, sometimes in the esoteric healing protocols, we learn that if the head center, the ajna, and the alta major center are all activated and forming an active triangle, then we can achieve this degree of at-one-ment or soul infusion. And also are the source of the radiation of healing energies. So, okay, it has to be faced that evil will come to the surface. Good calls evil to the surface. It's one of the laws, I think, later laws of healing. Herein lies much of the problem and much of the danger. Hence also the stress laid in such true schools upon the need of purity and truth. You know, cleanliness is next to godliness, and the devil is the father of lies. So impurity and untruth have a well-deserved bad reputation. And yet it will take courage to pursue both. Overemphasis has been laid upon the need for physical purity, and not sufficient emphasis laid upon the avoidance of all fanaticism and intolerance, which is a type of emotional mental impurity. It's an ide fix with fervid emotions attached. D.K. deals with this in the sixth rule for applicants in the initiation, human and solar. And instead of merely physical disciplines, there is the need for emotional loveliness, he calls it, and for mental clarity and acuity. We need to rid our various vehicles of the impediments which are customary to us and which we wouldn't think about very much unless we were really on the path of spirituality, where they become an obvious impediment. So these two qualities, fanaticism and intolerance, well, may be closer to us than we know, hinder the student far more than can wrong diet, and they feed the fires of separateness more than any other one factor. So let's somehow remember these two great impediments, which coming out of the sixth ray age, you know, are probably closer to us in the recent past than we may know at present. I certainly can find these things in myself and trace their origin to lives past, and their continuance even to the present life at times. It takes, I think, maybe a lot of courage to face these liabilities and realize that they are still in the way. Okay. Meditation involves the living of a one-pointed life always and every day. This perforce puts an undue strain on the brain cells, for it brings quiescent cells into activity and awakens the brain consciousness to the light of the soul. There was this student of the Tibetan, the very first one, in the Dyna books, a certain BSD, a third ray soul, but with a lot of sixth ray. And DK said, well, look, you know, you have brain fatigue from your many years of pursuing truth largely intellectually. And so I'm going to have to treat the assignment of meditation for you a little differently, and I'm going to hold off giving you any immediate meditation, but I will later try to develop you or develop some psychic responsiveness within you, higher psychism, of course. It's amazing how the Master sees into us and well, we know he can see at least several lives in the past, as can the Silver Angel, because he told one of his students, RSU, that where you are now is surprising considered to where you were several lives ago. Was it five lives? I'm not remembering exactly. But he sees the progress and he knows the tendencies, the skandhas, and the liabilities, and where a disciple has failed before. And those things which have to be guarded against. So anyway, one-pointedness without fatiguing the brain. This process of ordered meditation, when carried forward over a period of years, and supplemented by meditative living and one-pointed service. Again, one-pointedness, it's the quality of the disciple, very Sagittarian in a certain respect. The one-pointed disciple. This process will successfully arouse the entire system and bring the lower man under the influence and control of the spiritual man. You know, in Sagittarius and esoteric astrology, it discusses the straight line alignment, which is desirable and with which Sagittarius can assist, especially regarding, I think, the first two initiations. It will awaken also the centers of force in the etheric body and stimulate into activity that mysterious stream of energy which sleeps at the base of the spine. And, you know, that is that very powerful kundalini energy which has been, when improperly pursued, the ruination of so many ambitious disciples or aspirants, really. Maybe by the time we are disciples, we have a more level head, a more reasonable approach. So one-pointed meditation, one-pointed service, meditative living, and the goal being bringing the entire personality nature under the control of the spiritual man and eventually ending what's called the ancient authority of the threefold personality. And then the awakening of a number of chakras in proper order, given the monadic and soul rays. And even at a certain point when safe and indicated, the awakening of the kundalini fire. When this process is carried forward with care and due safeguards and under direction, in this case probably of a master, and when the process is spread over a long period of time, there is little risk of danger, and the awakening will take place normally and under the law of being itself. So even the slower method of awakening has its risks, but if the safeguards are observed and the process spread over a sufficiently long period of time, the major dangers will be avoided, and it's considered, you know, the normal method of awakening. And the law of being, what is that? Maybe the laws governing an emanation at a certain point of tension. All of us are emanations at a certain point of tension. And within the range of such points that typify the human kingdom. If, however, the tuning up and awakening is forced or is brought about by exercises of various kinds before the student is ready and before the bodies are coordinated and developed, then the aspirant is headed not just towards trouble, but towards disaster. Breathing exercises or pranayama training should never be undertaken without expert guidance and only after years of spiritual application, devotion, and service. BK has given some of these maybe lighter breathing exercises to his fairly experienced students, but maybe nothing like the breath of fire that people talk about and so forth. I know one man who really got involved in it. He survived it, but he really talks with awe and respect about God's holy fires, as he experienced the burning. So disaster awaits those who are injudicious or who force conditions without due supervision. Breathing exercises or pranayama training should never be undertaken without expert guidance and only after years of spiritual application. And how many of us have available to us at this particular time in humanity's development accessible expert guidance? We will. The hierarchy is planning to externalize, and a number of masters will be immediately accessible. But it is not generally yet the case. And only after years of spiritual application, devotion, and service, concentration upon the centers in the body, in the force body, with a view to their awakening, is ever to be avoided. It's better when the quality which the center represents is in process of development. Then the physical analog, the etheric analog to that quality, will naturally awaken. It will cause overstimulation if we, you know, focus upon a chakra with the purpose of stimulating it. And, you know, just think about what kind of retrogression might be possible if people focus on their sub-diaphragmatic chakras, emotionalism, hypersexuality, and when it comes to the base of the spine, you know, a fire which is destructive. So it will cause, if we do this, overstimulation and opening of doors onto the astral plane and probably the lower aspects of the astral plane, the so-called hell worlds of the seventh subplane, and things are not too much better on the sixth subplane, I would say. And the doors which the student may have difficulty in closing. Therein comes the much use of the color yellow to close the door, you know. I cannot impress too strongly upon aspirants in all occult schools that the yoga for this transition period is the yoga of one pointed intent, of directed purpose, of a constant practice of the presence of God, and of ordered, regular meditation carried forward systematically and steadily over the years. Now, what kind of yoga is that? Does it have yet a name? Is it Raja yoga? Is it, to a certain extent, Agni yoga, the yoga of synthesis? But what we must do is carefully laid out for us when we enter an esoteric school and when we become a little more familiar with what the esoteric school offers or know ahead of time, we should either not enter or leave if these are not the main types of cultivation. The yoga for this transition period between Pisces and Aquarius, is the yoga of one-pointed intent, producing the one-pointed disciple, of directed purpose, which building the Antikarana will allow in graded measure, of a constant presence, practice rather, of a constant practice of directed purpose, a constant practice of the presence of God. Well, you can practice directed purpose too, but the presence, the pervading factor, the ever-present one, the omniscient one, the omnipotent one, a pure being, and of ordered, regular meditation carried forward systematically and steadily over years of effort. Well, sounds demanding, doesn't it? And DK is not disguising the fact that true occult training is very demanding, and maybe only after we've been in it for a while do we realize how really demanding it is. But we have to keep our joy going and our enthusiasm and inspiration going, even though we know the road is long, that it winds uphill all the way, that probably our fondest goals will not be realized in the present incarnation, and yet we still persist. So when all this is done with detachment and is paralleled by a life of loving service, the awakening of the centers and the rising of the sleeping fire of Kundalini will go forward with safety and sanity, because so often insanity is the result of the Kundalinic forcing process, and the whole system will be brought to the requisite stage of aliveness. Well, you know, until we can really function in the cosmic ethers, I've often said, half jokingly, that we're half dead. And eventually we will be entirely vitalized by the cosmic principles, not just the systemic or solar principles that operate in the dense physical body of the solar logos or planetary logos. Real livingness will be ours, and the masters are characterized by that livingness. So we have to carry all these things forward, all these practices, all this regularity, all this order, all this sustainment of a point of tension, and we do it with detachment and accompany it by loving service. Is it a tall order? Yes, yes. Are there dangers? Yes. And is it worth doing? Everyone has to count the costs, make the decision. But for those who get into it, I'm sure they can't conceive how they would do otherwise. I cannot too strongly advise students against the following of intensive meditation processes for hours at a time, or against practices which have for their objective, the arousing of the fires of the body, the awakening of a particular center and the moving of the serpent fire. The general world stimulation is so great at this time, and is it not intensifying? And the average aspirant is so sensitive, he tells us how that sensitivity has been increased, often painfully, is so sensitive and finely organized that excessive meditation, a fanatical diet, the curtailing of the hours of sleep, or undue interest in and emphasis upon psychic experience will upset the mental balance and often do irretrievable harm. I mean, a harm which calls for slow and painful repair work over a number of future lives. So in fact, in this urge to rush ahead, one is throwing oneself backwards. Now, you know, to work in a school of esotericism, which suggests and even demands the proper practices, is not an easy choice, and it's not easily sustained. The personality always comes up with alibis. They come from livelihood areas, they come from health issues, they come from issues that concern relationship. You know, seventh house relationship, sixth house, 10th house, work and career, health issues, the ascendant and various high leg points in the chart. And just the lack of time, you know, or choices that do not seem to clear the necessary time to pursue the development properly. We enter the stage of development, very preliminary stages of development, very eagerly. And next thing we know, we are surrounded by personality demands. And they seem so importunate, so irresistible, so necessary to fulfill, that we just kind of drop our esoteric studies or work from a lesser point of tension than we otherwise might, accomplishing far more slowly and unstably what we otherwise might accomplish. So let us all be warned, because those moments of decision will come to us. And those who have been with it for quite a while know that they have come. And then at each such choice, the aspirant or disciple will decide whether to go forward, tread water, as it were, sustaining the status quo, or allow himself or herself to be pulled backwards into a lower state. It happens all the time until we begin to recognize what's going on and don't allow it to happen. Okay. Let the students, let's see, I just want to see. Yeah, well, we're getting there. Let the students in esoteric schools settle down to steady, quiet, unemotional work. Let them refrain from prolonged hours of study and of meditation. Their bodies are as yet incapable of the requisite tension, and they only damage themselves. Let them lead normal, busy lives. You know, it suggests the use of the ray of activity. The third, remembering in the press of daily duties and service who they are essentially and what are their goal and objectives. Let them meditate regularly every morning. I know a man who hasn't missed a day of meditation in his whole life, so he claims. Let them forget themselves in service and let them not concentrate their interest upon their own psychic development. And let them train their minds with a normal measure of study and learn to think intelligently so that their minds can balance their emotions and enable them to interpret correctly that which they contact and thus avoid illusion. As their measure of awareness increases and their consciousness expands. Well, you know, Master DK has this excellent, moderate advice. I'm sure we've all faced periods of immoderation. I know I have, sometimes studying 10 or 12 hours a day till I became dizzy and decided, wait, maybe I better not do this. Well, we learn often the hard way. But perhaps if encountering and believing Master DK's advice soon enough, we can avoid some of the very preventable pitfalls. There are other things we just can't avoid. The strain is inevitable. It should not be such excessive strain that we damage our vehicles, but strain is inevitable as we constantly attempt to increase our point of tension. Settle down. Quiet, unemotional work. Normal study. Not taking on more than you can handle. You know, Master Mori is sometimes very amusing. He says, well, just don't put the load of a camel on a donkey. And you can see here that most often for the beginner, the vehicles can't stand excessive burdening, even though Master Moria says at his level of Chohanic accomplishment, burden me still more as I enter the beautiful garden. Leading normal, here's the beginning of sanctified normality. Leading normal, busy lives. And remembering, of course, your own inner nature as you go on with normal living. And remembering who one really is and not getting lost in the samsara of things, you know, like a burning forest fire of illusion. Where illusion is burning up what is real. And that's the other side of it. What we want to do is burn up the illusion. So this is interesting. He gets specific. Let them meditate regularly every morning, beginning with a period of 15 minutes and never exceeding 40 minutes. Why not 45? Why not 35? Why not an hour? Well, DK is precise in his numbering. So I guess I would pay attention to what he says. Now, Foster Bailey meditated intensively and very briefly. when he did meditate, DK advised him, please meditate and you will solve many of your problems. But being the first-rate type, he probably wanted to get on with it, you know. And yet, DK said that his short meditations were among the most effective in the group. So just what does the master see? Probably when that day comes for us, we will be quite amazed regarding what we estimated to be the master's type of vision and what it actually was. Let them, the students, such good advice, I'm running over with good advice here. Let them forget themselves in service. Let them not concentrate their interest upon their own psychic development. The service is the thing, even of more value often than meditation. It's hard to believe, but thus it is. And he, emphasizing the value of service, lets us know that this is the case. It's possible to be selfish in anything. Selfish service, selfish study, selfish meditation. We just need to learn how to not fall for mistaken identity when we estimate who we really are. He tells us up here that we should not forget who we really are and should remember the inner God, you know. So let them train their minds with a normal measure of study and learn to think intelligently so that their minds can balance their emotions and enable them to interpret correctly that which they contact as their measure of awareness increases and their consciousness expands. Well, sanity, not the insanity of excessively fervid spiritual ambition. You know, that's easy to fall into, and some people, even though they know the words and they know what one should not do, they're latently spiritually ambitious. What I do when that kind of attack comes on me is I just think of absolute infinitude and the utter foolishness of thinking of being able to measure oneself against that, which reduces all attainment to an infinitesimal and even what I would call an absolute infinitesimal, as close to nothing or no thing as possible. And yet, as a consolation, what are we other than the absolute infinitude if we look for our super universal essence? Little more. Students need to remember that devotion to the path or to the master is not enough. DK had a nice way of saying this to a six-ray soul, first-ray personality, first-ray mind, six-ray astral, first-ray physical. He said, your orientation is more towards us than towards those you would serve or be obliged to serve. The man was very sensitive. And DK put it in a good way. It's not just towards us that you must focus your devotion, because that can cloak a hidden ambition to be just like them, you know, in terms of status. The great ones are looking for intelligent cooperators and workers more than they are looking for devotion to their, capital T, personalities, capital P. I mean, if you're devoted to the personality of a master, that's not what they're looking for. And the student who is walking independently in the light of his own soul is regarded by them as a more dependable instrument than a devoted fanatic. Well, there it is. And some of us may pride ourselves on our devotion to the great ones. And, you know, surely I'm more devoted than you are, kind of thing. And it ends up just being an expression of the trap of egoism, which is the result of misidentification of our true nature. I, the observer, don't really know who I am. Because if I did, I would drop that limited and limiting attitude and drop all sense of competition with other limited beings, temporarily limited. The light of the soul will reveal to the earnest aspirant the unity underlying all groups and enable him to eliminate the poison of intolerance, which taints and hinders so many. It will cause him to recognize the spiritual fundamentals which guide the steps of humanity. These spiritual fundamentals will be real to him. It will force him to overlook the intolerance and the fanaticism and separativeness which characterize the small mind and the beginner on the path. Well, it's almost as if when you begin, you are of small mind, relatively considered, and help him to so to love that they will begin to see more truly and enlarge their horizon. It will enable him to estimate truly the esoteric value of service and teach him above all to practice that harmlessness which is the outstanding quality of every son of God. Well, there it is. A harmlessness that speaks no word that can damage another person, that thinks no thought which could poison or produce misunderstanding, and which does no action which could hurt the least of his brethren. This is the main virtue and will enable the esoteric student to tread with safety the difficult path of development. Harmlessness. It's not the same as innocuousness, which is close to being weak and feeble. So this is the word, and at various places, I'm sure we have somewhere a compilation on harmlessness, and we must conduct a review regarding this most desirable of qualities, where the emphasis is laid upon service to one's fellow men, and the trend of life is outward to the world, not sort of a sick introversion which isolates. Then there is freedom from danger, and the aspirant can safely meditate and aspire and work. His motive is pure, and he is seeking to decentralize his personality. It's just one of many. and shift the focus of his attention away from himself in the lesser sense, to the group. And thus the life of the soul can pour through him and express itself as love to all beings. He knows himself to be a part of the whole, of a whole, and the life of that whole can flow through him consciously, leading him to a realization of brotherhood and of his oneness in relation to all manifested lives. Now here is Master DK speaking, and we know that he's not just speaking words. This is what he has achieved and what any true master of the wisdom has achieved. And if people claim to be a master of the wisdom and have not are not demonstrating these qualities of decentralization, pure motive, attention away from self and towards the group, love for all beings, no, then such an individual is not a real master. He has not mastered the ancient authority of the threefold personality. Freedom from, it's in Rays and the Initiations around page 686. I wonder if I find that. I wonder. Yes, it is page 685 and 686. Freedom from the control of the emotional nature, that's the objective for most, and freedom from the ancient authority of the threefold personality, marking a climaxing moment in the history of all initiates. DK does really choose his words with such care and tells us, of course, that we have to read carefully. And we don't. So this is what we are attempting to achieve. Master DK is helping us do this. It's the advice given is so sound, that we have to recognize its soundness and, of course, apply it. That's the key. And when it comes to harmlessness, well, that is the major factor, the harmlessness factor. So let's bear these things well in mind. Review them, not just read them once or listen once, but review and assimilate and apply. And then we will achieve, we will succeed, and we will be really useful, really, really useful. That is the key. Sometimes we think we are useful, but Master DK might say to us in one place, I think he did, what makes you so sure you are usable? I thought, well, everybody says, use me, Master. But then he comes back and says, well, are you sufficiently trained to be usable? So here's one of those great definitions of harmlessness, or describing the qualities of it. Speaks no word that can damage another person. Thinks no thought that could poison or produce misunderstanding, and which does no action which could hurt the least of his brethren. Well, really hurt, you know. I mean, sometimes you have to be straight about things, and harmlessness is not always gentle, feeble, futile, innocuous, you know. This is the main virtue which will enable the esoteric student to tread with safety the difficult path of development. So don't we think that we have enough to go on here? I think we do. It's just a question of being serious enough to do it, actually. Well, okay, I'm a little over an hour, but since I've reached the end of this particular section and am about to begin a new essay here, a new article, and let's see, you know, is it a long one? It's pretty long. And some of these other ones are shorter. It comes up to page 26, where we really change our subject and get into the great Seed Group project, which is also treated in Discipleship in the New Age Volume 1. Basically, he's not just repeating himself. He is giving different perspectives on it. We're aiming to reach page 61 because that from 0 to 61 is a part of the book which has not yet been videoed, and it's important. How much can we study? Well, maybe this goes up to page 20. Maybe not so much as to destroy our sanity, but at least an hour a day. That's what ended up being requested in the Arcane School, and we've gone up to page 20. So good. And I'll take this down now to right. So we finished number 4A, and we've gone from 15 to 20. Don't seem to be able to do more than 5 pages at a time, and even that's quite a bit. And we'll begin with 5A, 05A, on another date, not at the moment, and it'll be page 20 to whatever we succeed in doing. I just sometimes wish I could stay up all night just doing this, but there would be diminishing returns, I'm afraid. Well, we will participate in history. We may not have been in incarnation when some of these things were written. Probably not, you know. It would make us minimally 85 years old. Maybe there aren't so many people that are reading this now that are at that age. There are some, I know. And we'll just learn how to be better servers, more useful servers than now we are, by understanding why the advice is good advice and following to the best of our ability that advice. So, lots of love, many blessings on everybody, for everybody. And We will study within reason and meditate within reason. And serve within reason, not fanatically, which distorts the service offered and usually has an egoistic or egotistical motive. We will just proceed, quieting down to do the work as it must be done, and it's largely esoteric work, which at first needs to be in the background and beneath the surface so that it can really be effective. Okay. That's going to be it for now, and we'll see you on the next occasion with 05A. Bye for now.